You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day everybody, welcome back to the ESPN Footy Podcast for another week. My name is Matt Walsh and it's round zero. Opening round, whatever you want to call it, footy is back and we're here to talk you through it all. I'm joined by champion artist Christian Jolly and ESPN's Jared Barker. Welcome back to talk all things footy. JB, we'll be seeing more of you not only on the Tuesday pod throughout the year but also on our Thursday second weekly show. Red Time, of course, with Jake. Talk us through what to expect on Thursdays.
Yeah, exciting stuff. New podcast, as you said, called Red Time. So, just me and Jake Michaels, as you know. A couple of blokes with some bad footy takes going at it and debating all the hot topics in the game. So, yeah, we'll start that this week. We'll be going throughout the whole season. And, yeah, really exciting episode one as well. It'll be starting off with a bang with the fallout from the Jimmy Webster tribunal case and then looking ahead to this week's games and just talking through all the hot topics in the game.
Heaps to talk about, as per usual, but before we get into it, let's bring back this segment for 2024. Something you noticed from the weekend of footy. Christian, I might throw to you first up for this one. What took your fancy?
Yeah, plenty of things. I mean, we'll talk about the weekend of footy probably further down the track, but I've probably gone a bit overarching that. So we remember the grand final curse from last year where basically if you lose by 40 points in the grand final, you're not making finals or winning final the next year. So luckily Brisbane has avoided that curse with a small margin loss in the grand final. But the next step to that I actually looked at, again, after reading an article about how Brisbane feel they're going to get back into the grand final this year. And they've sort of spoken about because they have felt the pain of losing prelims. They've got so close to it. Winning one last year that they just expect to return back there based on the drive they've got from disappointment. But looking at it, since 2000, we've had 23 runners-up sort of complete the next season. Brisbane will be the 24th. And of those 23, only five have made the grand final the next year after losing it. So the most recent one of that was the Hawks, who lost the 2012 grand final to Sydney, came back and started their three-peat in 2013. With a victory, so not a bad way to sort of return to a grand final. But yeah, it's sort of been 10 or 11 years since we've actually seen a runner-up return to the grand final the next year.
Mm-hmm. So Lions are no hope, that's what he's saying.
They're either going to win a three-peat or they're not going to make the grand final.
Exactly, if you go back to week one, I did tip Brisbane to be the premiers and then I sort of stumbled across this stat week two. So yeah, I've sort of hedged my bets here and I can say I told you so either way.
You're right, because there are a few that used to do it. I think when I'm looking at this list here. So the Hawks, obviously, Geelong did it 2008, 2009. West Coast 2005 and then came back 2006 and won it. Collingwood 03, 04, St Kilda 9-10. It used to be rather commonplace, and maybe that's where maybe a lot of footy media goes, oh, they'll go one better or oh, they can make it back. But
and I'm guilty of that too. You clearly see a team get that close to the grand final and think, well, surely they take the next step the next year. But again, just looking at history says how
hard it is. As we've learned with footy, it's hard to make a grand final. It's hard to win one. That's certainly for sure. JB, something that took your fancy throughout the week?
Didn't take my fancy, but what I did notice was Matt Guelfi check-siding the footy when he was 20 metres out, probably only 15 metres out from goal. The first shot of the game as well in that game between Essendon and Geelong down at GMHBA. I was shocked when I saw him do that.
Don't understate the angle he was on as well. He was directly in front.
A tiny angle. Yeah, don't understate it. It was a tiny angle, but that doesn't excuse anything. There's bigger issues in the game, I guess, that I can be a little bit annoyed about, but usually when players are snapping like that, you can get away with it when you're on the boundary and when you're tied up against the boundary, it obviously makes sense. I don't think fans care. I don't think your teammates care. I don't think coaches care how the goals are kicked as long as the ball goes through the big sticks. But on this occasion, you're directly in front. Why on earth are you... Nothing grinds my gears more when I see a player going back from the mark, twisting his body 90 degrees, facing the bloody car park so he can spin the ball through because he's too scared to kick a drop punt.
There's another interesting one. Charlie Curnow did one similarly, not far out.
He kicks a lot of the ones that he goes
for. But he did it on his opposite foot. He backed his... left foot when his right foot was on a slight angle and he could have kicked a dry punt. I think if anything, pre-season is the time to try this sort of stuff.
Yep.
But I think if I was a coach, I'd be wanting you to practice the way that you're going to be kicking them in the home and away season.
If you can't drop punt the footy, the skill, the first thing you learn when you pick up a footy as a little tucker is a drop punt kick. So, anyway, what do you do?
Speaking of trying new things, I'm always on the lookout for signs that the centre bounce might be going the way of the dodo. I'm a big centre bounce fan. I think it's one of the most unique things we have and one of the only last sort of unique things we have in the game. But especially in pre-season, you can kind of see the AFL try a couple of different things. The umpires are hot on certain free kicks and that kind of stuff. But I got to say, I was pleasantly surprised to notice that for the most part, umpires were bouncing the ball after goals. So it looks like it remains for at least another year.
You'll be happy.
Be very happy.
Was it different last year? Were they throwing it up more in the preseason?
No. But I'm just always on the lookout for signs that they will try something different. And by try something different, I mean just get rid of it completely. So good to see it's still around.
That'd
for
be
now.
Your worst nightmare.
If it went.
Yeah.
No, I just think it's a fun, quirky, like, it means that instead of being a completely...
It's a footy thing.
It's a bit random.
Yeah,
bit of a footy thing. Anyway, let's get to the main body of the pod. Plenty to talk about, as I said off the top. And it's not the back pages the AFL would have wanted coming out of the weekend, that's for sure. As you said, JB, Jimmy Webster's hit on Jai Simkin was a sickening bump after the ball had been disposed of. There was remonstration from North Melbourne players and coach Alistair Clarkson as well. So there are many layers to this, but he's been sent straight to the tribunal. And, you know, it's so sad, I think, to see an incident like this occurring so soon after Gus Brayshaw announced his retirement due to concussion. And obviously the past 12 months in terms of the discussion regarding, CTE, brain injuries from players in past generations as well. To see this sort of incident was extremely disappointing. And obviously straight to the tribunal was expected. But now it's about what's appropriate for this kind of act. And in 2024, you kind of think and hope the AFL is wiping the slate clean and there'll be a significant punishment that will begin to deter these kind of acts.
Yeah, it's going to be a hefty suspension that he does get. I think we're all expecting that. It's just, it's a brain fade, but it's a stupid brain fade as well, especially, as you said, the new conversation we're having around concussion in this game and the lawsuit that's hanging over the AFL or potential lawsuit at the moment. Mm. I mean, yeah, it's the concussion, obviously, no one goes out there wanting to concuss a player. And so I still err on the line of caution when I talk about these incidents because I don't like saying that he did it intentionally, but he intended to bump and now he needs to live with those consequences.
Correct, yes.
It's mind-boggling that a player does that during the preseason as well. But parking aside the Jimmy Webster name, I can't pretend like I know what it's like to be out there in a fast-paced game and playing at the top level and trying to change your mind in the split second like that. It must be a hard thing to do as much as it was a brain fade by him. But parking Jimmy Webster aside, he's going to cop his punishment. The thing that interests me is the conversation that's happened based on this bump. And it's the people calling for the 6 weeks, the 8 weeks, the 10 weeks, the 12 weeks. None of it's surprising. Even when I'm saying those numbers, you're nodding because it's like, well, yeah, that's what he might get. But it's the AFL trying to make a statement. So do they give him the 8 week or the 10 week ban? But what my question is, what is a statement? Because I'd like to think players know they're not allowed to bump when they go out there. I'm just wondering if Jimmy Webster gets 5 weeks, more than the 4 weeks that Power Pepper deservedly got, a player's going to go, oh, he got 5 weeks. That's a statement. They know not to bump.
The groundswell of support for these bigger numbers is encouraging, I think, when it comes from the broader community of footy and not just, outraged fans of the player.
It's this new community expectations that they have.
The expectations are shifting, and I think the AFL plays an important role in this, in keeping up with community expectations of what is deserved. And what's appropriate? I mean, this is the question, right? So you look at acts in the past that were probably obviously more intentional. You look at Andrew Gaff on Andrew Brayshaw. You look at Barry Hall going back many, many years. I think they got 8 and 7 weeks respectively. And those were normally, that's reserved for really bad acts on the field, right? I can sort of see this becoming the new thing. If you're launching yourself at someone and causing, what we now know could be irreparable damage to one's brain, I think that that's something you need to just stamp out of footy. And younger generations, we'll thank ourselves for doing this in 10 years' time when those that have grown up playing footy and that are, starting to play footy now come into the league and they know not to do that action. But banning him for an appropriate amount of time, what's appropriate That's the thing. But it's just so strange.
The statement's
to look
back. The same between 6 and 12 weeks, no matter what he gets.
It's a big statement.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just so interesting that, you know, more than 12 months ago was Cozzy Pickett, horizontally going at Bailey Smith. He only got 2 weeks for that. And it's just so interesting to see how quickly the mindset and the attitudes towards this have shifted, and quite dramatically as well.
That's where the outcome outweighed the action at that stage. And it's good that the AFL's starting to swing now and actually punish the action.
But as would they be punishing him more? Would there be a call for 6 and 8 weeks if Simpkin had been bumped and then gotten him up straight away? This is the question.
Well, I would like to say yes, but I don't think that's the case. Yeah.
The interesting thing out of this, language from St Kilda and Ross Lyon coming out of this weekend was very interesting. I think clubs are starting to understand the importance of this. Of course, you look at St Kilda. Paddy McCartan was a player who suffered many concussions playing for that club, and I think St Kilda have been really careful with this. Lyon said clearly, there's no defence for it. When in years gone by, your coach probably comes to your defence a bit more. The Saints said, you know, we will respectfully accept the outcome of the tribunal. You think in years gone by, the club goes, oh, no, we will defend, we'll try and get them. I think that these winds of change in terms of the language that clubs and players and administrators and footy heads are using is starting to understand that this is a really significant issue and one that's clearly not going to just go away overnight.
Well, that's why I find this one hard to judge whether it is that the clubs are coming around and starting to, you know, again, we can go back 4 or 5 months ago to the Maynard one and some people are saying completely innocent, some people are saying 6 weeks. There was just a big breadth of, you know, discussion amongst that one. Whereas this one, everyone seems to be on the same page. Whether that's the industry coming around to sort of, you know, the same mindset, or whether the way I look at it is this incident was just so bad and out of the box and you just don't see it anymore, that everyone just knew instantly that there was no attempt to smother. There was no, oh, he's changed from a tackle, or the power pepper one got slung into it. There's always some sort of other factor. It was like, that's just a blatant, late high
it's
hit. So again, it's good that the industry's coming around, but I wouldn't use this as the case to prove that it has happened. I think we need to see round one or two when the club start, you know, someone does get knocked out, the club goes, oh, no, that was accidental.
No, I would like to see the AFL appropriately punish the act and not the outcome. Once I start to see that, where, oh, that was a dangerous act, you had the potential to cause severe injury like what we, you know, have seen with Simpkin, you're going to be rubbed out for three or four weeks.
And clubs don't challenge that. That's what I'm saying. It's the ones where the clubs challenge, where you go, hang on, why are you challenging that? If that happened to your player, you know, you'd go the other way.
The next part is changing that grading system, because it was graded as careless and not intentional. But it's an intentional act. He didn't intend to concuss Simpkin, as I said before. Yes. But he intended to bump him.
Yes.
And now he needs to live with that consequence. But I find it weird that they don't judge that an intentional...
Regardless, it was going to the tribunal, though. This is the thing.
Yeah, well, it had to. But, I mean, what happens now with the bump? I mean, bumps are still a part of this game, right? What happens now? Our players are going to be too scared to go in for the footy as they...
Potentially.
The same way they have?
I don't think footy losers... This is going to be a controversial opinion to some. I don't think footy losers a terrible amount by, like, you know, banning bumps like that. Mm. I think, you know, little ones in contests is going to be fine, but I think if you ban that bump, I don't think that's a big deal at all.
It's when you had other options, I think.
Yeah. Depending on when you are listening to this podcast, you will find out, you might know, actually, the outcome of the tribunal, and obviously something to discuss further on Red Time, JB.
We'll be all over it.
Exactly.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Christian, the question I get asked a lot, the question I see a lot from footy fans is, how much can we actually take away from pre-season games? Should we be scared if we're Gold Coast fans, looking at their two performances and wondering whether the Hardwick experiment might fail early, or is West Coast going to be as bad as we think already? Do stats broadly reflect the fortunes that clubs employ in home and away? Should we be looking and delving too far into stats in pre-season, or is it just, hey, take a step back, they're trying things, we'll see what happens in round zero.
Round zero now, yeah, exactly. So, again, I mean, the simple answer is, can you take a game from last year, just one game from last year, randomly for Collingwood, and say, that's how your season's going to play out? And of course you can't. So that's what we're getting here. We're getting one game against one opposition at one venue. So, again, there's a few things that you can definitely look at. And again, it's more about looking at when the ball is in your hands. Are you kicking more, handballing more, kicking forward more, handballing, you know, meters gained and things like that. That you can sort of get a read on from some of the clubs. But again, a lot of the other stuff is just random in the game. Whether you lose the contested possession count or not, might just be, again, up against the opposition you're up against or the way they've set up. So again, there's certain stats that you might have a quick look at for each team, but you wouldn't make an overarching statement of, you know, looking at their... You talk about something like the Premiership standards where we were looking at last year with the 32 key stats. You're not looking at any of those and making a big call of, oh, they finished 17th in this stat, they're not going to make the finals. Yep. It's more about, okay, what is it? How much has they have tinkered with their game style? Are they kicking, handballing more, et cetera, et cetera? But again, I mean, you look at the preseason, and again, I don't know how long preseason's only been shortened to 1 week. We used to get 3 weeks of Wizard Cup back in the day and things like that. So it used to be a lot more sort of data that you could use. But I just sort of compared last year's preseason to the 2023 home and away season and then sort of got this year's numbers to sort of see, okay, what might happen. So last year during the preseason was 84.8 points per game per team. By the home and away season, we're down to 83.7. So there's about, you know,
1.1.
Yeah, 1.1 more points kicked in preseason than home and away. This year's preseason, we're down to 76.9 points per game, which is down below that 80 mark is, you know, dire number.
Below. Yeah, goal a game
alone would be one of the lowest seasons. So again, if that drops another 1 point, we're looking at 75 points per game. You hope that's not the case.
We thought scoring was increasing last year. Now so, the indication may be, take it with a grain of salt, obviously.
Yeah, so the one for me is probably looking at the ball movement as well. So the scoring went down, and the big talk over the preseason is every club during preseason training has looked at how to increase ball movement, how to become more exciting with ball movement, how to take the game on and become more dynamic. I think the one thing we forget about is when teams hear that, they also spend the whole summer practicing how to defend the other team's ball movement. And I think defence has won for week one of one week of preseason. Defence definitely won out this week. So preseason last year, you go from the back 50 to forward 50 23% of the time. By home and away season, we're down to 21% of the time that you went from back 50 to forward 50. This was down to below 19% in the preseason. So again, harder to move the ball down below any number between that 20% number is again in danger of being the worst season ever for moving the ball. And sort of, you know, the kicking efficiency stayed, this was very similar to last year in the home and away. So teams are still hitting targets and moving the ball similarly. It's just that they weren't getting that. You're seeing a lot more teams defend that last 70 metres of the ground much better because they're expecting teams to be moving the ball fast to get the defence back
fast. I wouldn't say this surprises me. I think this is, you know, you kind of look over a period of a couple of years and transition from back 50 to forward 50 was something that the good teams did really well. Yep. So obviously, and there might always be a bit of lag when it comes to defending this, teams are going to try and stop that. So we might be starting to see a swing back towards maybe a more contested game or a bit more of a stoppage-based game compared to one that was a bit more sort of like, you know, rebound, slingshot off half-back. Is that kind of what you're alluding to? A small sample size,
so.
Of course.
I think so, and again, I was hoping to see, yes, I expect that. The defences will get stingy and it'll be harder to move the ball. But again, if both teams are out there with the mindset of once we got the ball, we want to take the game on, then surely we're going to see less contest and the game is going to open up. As long as both teams keep that mindset of, yes, we're going to defend when we don't have the ball, but we're going to do this. When we get the ball, we're going to go fast. We've seen teams previously in the past that probably aren't, you know, up to the standard of really trying to clog games up. And some of the poorer teams have really high stoppage games or really lots of backwards kicks and short, just trying to sort of waste time and not get hurt. I think we're sort of starting to see at least, you know, even Hawthorn, who, you know, a lot of people might have in their bottom four this year, they're trying to become the most dynamic ball movement. We're talking about... What's North called their new one? Not their Baz ball, yes, but yeah, they've got a new name. So they're preaching that big high ball movement. So they've gone from the
North ball.
Yeah, so they're going from the sort of let's protect ourselves and build our list and just sort of hang in there to all right, now let's sort of have some dare in our game. And we might get same as the Hawthorn mindset last year. If we get beaten by 80 points, that's fine, as long as we're continually learning how we want to move.
How much of this though is the fact that it's a practice game and you know, players aren't going full tilt? Are they going, okay, today we're just going to, you know, practice our defensive mechanisms? And then, I mean, how are you supposed to
tell? Yeah, exactly. So that's, again, a lot of the focus, I think, in preseason when you go out there is like, let's try to really maximise our offensive potential. You look at just a simple number like pressure factor during the preseason. It was at 175 last year's preseason, up to 181 during a home and away season, 184, 185 by finals time. We were down to 174 again, which is, again, a big drop. So there isn't a big focus probably on pressure and smashing in at the ball carrier and being really physical. It's more about keep our structure behind the ball and when we get the ball, let's test our ball movement. And
to your point before, and sort of similar to the question that you had, is you know, because there's now only one real quote-unquote game of pre-season, do you find that clubs are probably going to be employing the tactics that we see on in the pre-season more in the home and away compared to, say, during the Wizard Cup where there might be a few more sort of dice thrown around the board?
Maybe a little bit. And again, I think we were probably at an industry 10, 12 years ago where there was a lot of coaches that always had that mindset of, let's keep things close to my chest. I don't want everyone else to see what I'm doing. Now I feel like, again, this is very...
Any practice is good practice,
right? Yeah, and this is very much sort of second hand, but I feel like the clubs are more open to, this is what we're trying to do. We're gonna focus on ourselves. We're not gonna handle a lot in the preseason because we're gonna plan to kick a lot in the home and away, which is probably what you would see back in the day. Forwards playing back, Sydney with Longmire always sort of, you know, never put out a real preseason team, and you never really knew how they were going to go into round one. I think teams are really sort of going, well, don't care if you see us, this is what we're going to be.
So in that case, there are a couple of interesting notes that you've got here, and we were talking about a couple of these off-air before, and it's that, you know, Geelong, arguably the team with the most 30-plus-year-old players on their list, they are trying to go fast this season.
Yeah, so they've always spoken about that in the last 3 or 4 years. I know that they spoke about some of their finals losses, the prelims were... Their ball movement just sort of didn't stack up come finals times. They were very slow and methodical during the home and away, which got them a lot of wins. But in finals, it was a lot more chaotic, and you just need to go sometimes without thinking. Again, one game for them. They had 591 metres gained by handball against the Bombers. They averaged 270 per game last year, which was six. The most they had in a game last year was just over 400. So the 591 metres gain, that would have been their most in a game since 2015.
And so this is a different approach.
Again, this isn't
like an out-of-the-box thing. This is going to be a trend.
Well, again, making a big call from one game in the preseason, but also just hearing some of the talk from some of the players coming out of Geelong about they did want to look at speed and keeping the ball moving.
You wouldn't think
like
they'd do that for one practice game and then just abandon it?
No, of course not. But those numbers, anyway, 591 metres gained by handball per game, that's kind of like Richmond.
Yeah,
in
so Richmond,
their heyday.
Richmond was
Orange four, Tsunami last year.
Yeah, well, Richmond at their best, so 2019, I think they were at 470. The next most was about 240 metres gained. A lot more teams have got in between the 350 to 400 range. Essendon, Collingwood, Richmond all did it similar last year, but Geelong just took it to another level. So 591, so one game for them. Going the other way, West Coast, who were sort of spoken about for years, sort of they won the 2018 Premiership on a very kick mark style game, backwards and sideways kicks, and just sort of try to slowly and methodically move the ball around and protect themselves. Just a small one. I mean, they didn't have the greatest game against Adelaide. They were probably never really in the contest, but they had zero backwards kicks for the game. So they just refused to kick backwards from any of their marks or general play. They at least had, I think, two backwards kicks in every game last year, but... The one for me is across a 4-year period, they kicked backwards 1,100 times. It was about 100 or 200 more times than any other team, and twice as many as Melbourne, who were last. So, you know, who were sort of.
So that again, that's
a very small 1 week
direction
thing.
To be like, well, we really struggle to firstly move the ball, secondly actually get it out of our defence, and we need to kind of just get ball, go forward, attack.
And you look at Richmond and Collingwood and that and. Collingwood know when to slow the game down, but at Richmond were very rarely going backwards once they had the ball. It was always about taking ground.
But inexperienced and poorer teams, I don't want to say not a bad thing, but it's an attitude you can kind of understand.
Yep.
And you say, well, we just need to get the ball out of wherever it is to get towards our goal. And that way we give players up the ground a little bit more of a chance to actually get the footy and try and create something.
Which in turn makes it easier for them to defend when the ball's coming from such
potentially.
A...
Potentially. But yes, I think you can definitely see the direction there of just being like, hey, let's just try and move the ball forward at any opportunity we can. Because I think they know, I think we know, I think fans know, I think the footy industry knows West Coast are going to struggle again this year, and any little wins they can have, whether that's, you know, a little bit more time in forward half, I'm sure that they'll hang their hat on.
And same as Hawthorn last year, this year is not about winning games. This year is about setting up your game style to, okay, how are we going to sort of, you know, win games in 2 or 3 years? And I think maybe stepping up into that more of attacking style, you know, with ball in hand might be where West Coast is heading to. Another small one, again, just a negative stat. Frio, just, again, one of their problems last year, and whether this was designed for the game, one of their problems last year is they got stuck just kicking the ball around and taking too many marks sometimes.
Right.
Very similar to what we spoke about for West Coast, but they had the fewest marks of any team for the round, so they just didn't do it. I know the conditions were a little bit windier there, I think, but, again, how much that had to do with the opposition they were playing and things like that. But yeah, it didn't look good for Freo in terms of whether that was something they didn't want to get caught chipping the ball around too much and they just wanted to keep
the ball movement last year, they struggled with that a lot.
Yeah.
And they were one of the poorer sides to watch. Yeah.
And they didn't have a lot of success moving the ball, and they also took a low amount of marks. So sort of like, well, did Freo sort of try to abandon one part of the, just that part of the game that we're probably just trying to draw back a little bit? We don't want to get stuck taking too many marks in our back half and not doing anything with it. But as I said, they probably didn't have the scoreboard success to match that. And another little one, quirky one, Brisbane. Sort of spoke about them last year. I think they were third last for disposals per game. I think they had the second worst uncontested possession differential of anyone. So they don't mess with exactly what we're saying about Freo and West Coast. Once Brisbane get the ball, they're taking ground, they're going forward, they're kicking, they're happy to go to another stoppage, get the ball out of bounds, reset and win that clearance. Just coming out of the back line again, they were ultra conservative. So 34 times they came out of back 50. They used the corridor zero times. They used the wing, which is sort of, the logos, if you as such, painted on out there. They used that only four times, and they came up hard against the boundary 30 times out of defensive 50.
Wow, so that's interesting.
We know that teams, when they come out boundary side, it's to protect yourselves from that turnover in the middle of the ground. But again, you'd have to go back and watch all of them in isolation, whether this was by choice that they just refused to take the corridor or whether they were being played that way by Sydney. I was working on the other game, unfortunately. But again, it's just that one number where it's like, Brisbane know how to protect themselves from turnovers. One is keep taking ground and win contests, but two might be, when we've got the ball, let's actually go really wide in the back half and then come into the corridor in the forward.
They might be very confident with, I think the chaotic play through the corridor is the stuff that kind of works really well. And then the wing, obviously a bit more structured, and then the boundary stuff is the stuff that can go wrong pretty quickly because it's probably a little bit slower. It's probably a little bit more propensity to be stoppages, throw-ins.
Yeah.
And so if you can work on that more.
Yeah, but we know that Brisbane, again, best clearance team last year, one of the best scoring from stoppages. So if they lose possession of the ball, it goes out of bounds, they're probably
confident
still
enough to get it back.
Yeah, to win them.
Any little player quirks that we sort of noticed?
Again, spent a lot of time talking about teams, and if you do look at, personally, when I look at preseason, I'm more player-wise. You can get a lot about how a player's going to go and what role they're playing, how much confidence they have in that role, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of the times I watch a preseason and it's more about what players are stood out and what player roles are changed. So just got a list here of sort of guys that are either on a new team or haven't established themselves in a team for the past few years and some of the standout things that we've seen from them. So Gibkiss had 11 spoils for the round, which is three more than any other player. So we know Josh Gibkiss had a year off with a hamstring injury for Richmond last year, first round pick a couple of years ago. I think a lot of, and they've moved Noah Bolter down forward. So a lot of their back line success will rest on Gibkiss's shoulders this year. And yeah, good signs there with his spoils. Jack Ginnivan, good start in the new stripes, the brown and gold stripes. Had five marks inside 50, which is the equal most of anyone for the round. So good start there.
Flush with small forwards, the Hawks.
Exactly, yeah. We're working in tandem with Nick Watson down there. Buku Kamis, we've seen him flip end for the Dogs. He was recruited as a defender. Hadn't made it in the team. They had played him forward for the last couple of years. They put him back into the fence and he took a round high five intercept marks. So he looked good down there. And again, another one with the Dogs that we spoke about there. Their key defence was probably a little bit vulnerable last year. So they're still trying to sort of find a consistent pillar to stand next to Liam Jones probably. And Karmas looked good. Two guys that played down back. So I think Sexton had the 31 touches for Gold Coast and Zach Fisher, 36 touches. Was the second most of the round, Zach Fisher. So second to Jai Newcomb with the 36 touches. Those two were just given the ball at every opportunity. So they called for it and they got given it. So I don't know. I don't know how to rate Fisher's game. Again, 36 disposals. I think he had the 7 turnovers. 4 of those led to an opposition goal. And he had 2 score involvements himself. So it was one of those ones where a lot... And Sexton was very similar in those numbers. Didn't have as many turnovers. Had a slightly more score involvements. But it was a lot of 36 touches for Zach Fisher that sort of didn't result in much for North Melbourne. So he would have walked off the ground feeling very confident in that role. North Melbourne would have liked him in that role, but I still struggle to see, if they get better and do want to sort of put a score on the scoreboard, is he actually going to provide some drive?
Both
out of
are
there?
Work in progress as exactly. prior and forwards. I can see that working. They're both, Fisher had a lot of
And your first week down there, to have the ball in your hands 30 times, that's got to give you confidence and
for sure.
sort of, And both of those players, I think you're going to have to take the bad with the good because they are attacking players in your back half. Yeah. They're going to have to take the risks. Just a free kick one. Darcy Wilson was quite impressive for St Kilda, sort of wing half forward. 6 free kicks, 1 for himself and 1 given away. So he had a +5 differential for a young kid in his first game playing
amongst
friends.
6 frees, 4.
Yeah, so it's...
Well, the umpire's looking after the younger brigade.
Exactly the next player on the list. There is a few players, Ruckman, I think, that had a 5-3-4s and zeros against.
Rules.
But Wardlaw was up there as well. And again, I love Wardlaw, or Warlord, as we're calling him when we're calling the stats. But 4 free kicks for him, 0 against. He's just see ball, get ball, and in there first. But two young guys that sort of, again, you know, Darcy Wilson, as I said, 6 frees, 4s. 1 against, must have felt being... pretty good out there for his first game.
Do you know what the frees were for?
I can get them, but no, I haven't got them listed here. Another St Kilda player, Riley Bonner, looked really good, kicked a beautiful goal from outside 50. He was equal second this week for inside 50s and rebound 50s combined. So he had 13 of those, you know, 7 insides and 6 rebounds. The only player that had more was Jaden Short, who had 12 rebounds and 2 insides. So a lot of more of Jaden Short's was done in one half of the ground. Riley Bonner getting up and back. Liam Henry had 34 pressure acts for the round, which is the third most of anybody. So the first two were Josh Kelly and Zach Merritt, right up there. But yeah, fourth was Wardlaw, fifth was Huswaite, and third was Henry. So a few new names there. And then I want to go back and change my tip last week. I think I tipped Elijah Sardis to win the Rising Star. I think I've seen the Rising Star play on the weekend. Riley Sanders, 10 score involvements. Only Toby Green and Pat Lipinski had more. But just the way, the balance of him, he's always standing upright, he's always got the ball, he's always able to sort of...
Something in the Horn Francis, doesn't he?
Something in the socks up, maybe, the a bit Horn of extra Francis, balance through the contest.
It's the balance, exactly that. He just never loses his feet. So, yeah, there's some of the really good standouts from pre-season.
Well, there you go. There's some things to look out for as we enter the opening round. I keep going to say round one. I don't know why I keep doing this, but it's definitely opening round.
The commentators... yeah, flipped and flopped all week for me. Round zero, round one, round two, I'm losing it.
JB, opening round, round zero, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Will it work? Because I know that Andrew Dillon last night was on, I think it was on 360, and we said all four games will either be a sellout or they'll be close to selling out, which means we've got 4 blockbusters penciled in. Round one, as in round one proper. We'll also have a number of big games, big crowds, all that kind of stuff. I think the AFL's convinced. It just seems like fans aren't quite convinced, but can you see it working?
It'll work. I think it will work, and I'm not as against the idea as a lot of people seem to be. I guess I understand the idea of trying to grow the game in those northern states, Queensland and New South Wales, which aren't traditional Aussie rules states. So getting the eyeballs up there, I get the idea of it, and bringing up clubs like Collingwood and Carlton and Richmond, the big drawing clubs, is the right idea. So you are going to get a lot of eyeballs on those games anyway. So I think it will work. It, for me, they've fixtured it the right way for it to work. I'm just like you, I'm against the idea. I don't know. It's a bit funny calling it round zero or opening round or whatever it wants to be. It's just make it round one and Carlton and Richmond on a Thursday, just kick off round two next week.
Yeah, I'm with that. And again, a lot of the industry complaining about the buys and the ladder's going to be off. Just deal with it. It's going to be 6 or 7 weeks.
At the end of the day, they'll all play the same number of games.
Exactly, by the end of the year. So all the people are sort of
it's the buys
getting a bit
in
iffy of how you're going to read the ladder properly in round five. Well, you won't. You'll know in round seven when everyone's played even games.
No, I agree. I think it'll be a resounding success, and it'll be enough for the AFL to say we'll keep doing it.
I think it's as big a deal as people are making. I think it's going to be okay.
Great season for storylines for it too, because you got obviously Grundy going to Sydney the right time. You got Dimmer in the Gold Coast. You've got Collingwood and Brisbane and their opponents all played in the prelims. So a great year where you sort of were able to go off the back of 2023 and piggyback off that.
I think they've set it up really well.
Yeah. I agree. Christian, he sent through some interesting stuff last week that we didn't quite get the chance to get to. Some list quirks coming into 2024. I think the thing that really interested me, and I know that this is such a random spot to sort of just cut things off, but in terms of like the number of 30-plus-year-old players on a list, I think the number one team was pretty obvious in that it was always going to be Geelong. And of course, they remain the number one team. But the team that's second on the list surprised me.
Yeah, so Collingwood, the oldest list by average is Collingwood this year, ahead of Geelong. Geelong have 11 30-year-olds, though. Collingwood have 9. So that's...
up from 5 last
year. 5 last year. So
the last two premiers...
have been the oldest lists, have they not?
Well, Collingwood
coming into this year.
Collingwood was the fifth oldest coming into their into the premiership year, and now they've risen to the oldest this year. And Geelong were the oldest in 2022, were the second oldest last year, and will come in as the second oldest this year again. So, sort of Collingwood haven't really recruited a new 30-year-old, though. It's just been Chris, Poskin, Tom Mitchell, Majacek. They've all sort of got older and sort of added to that number. And similar with St Kilda, who only had one 30-year-old at the start of last year's season. They've got six now. But again, that was just all because of the guys that have just had birthdays. So one of those is Webster, Brad Hill, Mason Wood, Brad Crouch, Seb Ross. So it's not like a lot of teams went and recruited 30-year-olds. But as I said, St Kilda is sort of moving up from, you know, only having one to six and trying to consolidate themselves in top eight. Two teams that have gone the other way, which you'd expect to. West Coast had five at the start. Sorry, West Coast had seven at the start of last year. They're down to five this year. We probably spoke about it round 20 last year, how deep they were going to cut into those seven 30-year-olds. Well, they got rid of two of them. And North made a really deep cut. So they still had six over 30-year-olds on their list at the start of last year. They're down to two now this year. So
I think this tells a bit of an interesting story, this little table, where it's like if you're gunning for flags, you are getting older. And if you are, you know, a poor team that is just sort of like, oh, the bottom is not yet here, you are cutting and you are becoming younger. And we sort of looked at Hawthorn last year. A lot of the talk was, had they cut too deep? Mm. I think they still ended up having a pretty decent year, all things
it's
considered.
Funny. It's funny because you always look at these older teams and people go, oh, they're going to fall off a cliff really shortly. And you look at Geelong and 11 players over 30, they've sort of been like that for the last few years. And the conversation is always the same around them. Oh, this is the year they're going to drop off. But now you look at Collingwood with nine players over 30 this year. I think it helps when you've got players that are still performing when they are over 30.
I mean, so when you've got the 36-year-old who's doing incredible things, well, like Scott Penderbury.
When you've got players as durable as even a Sidebottom and Penderbury, who arguably are playing at their peak later in their career, and the last quarter of Scott Penderbury's grand final was arguably the best quarter of footy he's actually ever played. So that helps in a way. Mm. And interesting, looking at these names as well, I look back right now to the 2018 grand final with Collingwood's list and guys like Darcy Moore, who didn't play in that game, Jordan DeGoey, Braden Maynard, were all 22 back then. They're now 28 and creeping up towards 30 as well. Jack Crisp is 30, Hoskin Elliott, Brody Mychek, they were all 24 back then. So it helps when you've got that core group of players together. As much as the Pies have had a lot of change these last few years, they've kept a core group together,
right?
And now they're all over 30, and that's probably why they've been so successful.
Just looking at the five oldest list and the five youngest list sort of, you know, show that picture of where teams are at probably for most of them.
So there's one outlier.
Yeah, exactly, in each of them. So in the oldest list, you've got Collingwood, Geelong, Melbourne and Brisbane as the top four, and Richmond, who are still fifth. So again, a lot of Richmond, it's changed coach, and there's going to be a new flavour at Richmond this year, but their list is still very... The crux of it is still from 2019, 2017. They've still got a fair few players from there and quite an old list. And the youngest list going the other way. So North Melbourne, Hawthorn, West Coast and Freo are the four youngest teams who you think wouldn't be too surprised to miss finals. Adelaide's the fifth youngest. And I've got them making a prelim, and I think there is a lot of excitement around them. They were the second youngest last year. They're now the fifth youngest this year. So they're moving up the ladder a little bit. But again, it's not, you know, if Adelaide missed the finals again this year, I'm tipping him next year again, because they're still in that sweet spot where another year of
it. Do the stats point to a sweet spot in age for being either, you know, winning premierships or making grand finals or being there in the last 2 weeks of the season? Can we kind of look at it, what an average age is, or the median age, or whatever?
Well, you couldn't use average. So average age has actually gone up across the competition. So we're almost probably 18 months older than as a competition than we were 15 years ago. We dropped down to the youngest the competition ever was in 2011, when we had the Gold Coast expansion club come in and things like that. So 2010 was actually lower. So 22.9 was the average age of a player in 2010. We're now up to 24.3 this year. So, you know, at one year and a quarter older sort of thing across the list this year. So in terms of, you know, West Coast, when they won the premiership in 2018, they were 23 and a half was their average age. Only three teams are younger than that this year. So even though West Coast was the 11th oldest, they were youngish, but they weren't at the bottom of the table.
Yep.
If they had that same age profile this year, they'd be 16th, 17th. So just looking at your actual age number, there's probably not too much in it just because the competition's gotten older. But in a quick look, and it probably pays to be, again, this is going back to 2008, only two teams have won it outside the top 10 for age.
Right, so you can be too young.
Yeah, and only, again, probably you could go top seven. Only three haven't been in the top seven for age and won the premiership. So that was Melbourne in 2021 were the eighth oldest. Richmond 2020 and Richmond 2019 were the 10th oldest. And West Coast being the 11th and 13th oldest in 2016, 2018. So there was four of the last seven have won it being outside the top eight. But before that, you needed to be older. So We've seen it flip and flop. We've seen the oldest team win it 2 years ago in Geelong. And as I said, but going back to 2018, 2016, when West Coast and Bulldogs won it, they were the younger teams in the competition.
Can't predict it from the age then. Fair enough.
Well, North Melbourne, two players over 30. So do Carlton. And I mean, there's a lot of hype around them this year as well. So they look prime.
Well, I think the Blues are kind of in that spot where you talked about the Pies 2018, as they are growing older together. So maybe the Blues still have a lot of good footy ahead of them. Any other list quirks? I know that you were kind of looking through sort of position-based stuff and found some really interesting things, especially surrounding Melbourne and Richmond and Adelaide and Ruckman and key forwards and general forwards. Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting stuff here.
I don't know how many positions there are at each of the clubs. You've got national list managers and recruiting managers and talent acquisition and all this stuff. But sometimes you sort of, when we get the list at the end, you think, geez, they're going to have to move some of these guys out of their natural position just because they've got too many of them. So the one for me is Richmond. So Richmond have 11 general defenders, which is the most of any team, but they only have 3 key defenders listed.
Right.
And one of those is Noah Bolter, who we know they're trying, probably play forward. He'll start the season as a forward. So that leaves them with 2 recognised key defenders from our listings, being Tyler Young and Josh Gibkiss, who we just spoke about earlier. So Dylan Grimes is another one that could play that role. He's listed as a general defender because of the last 2 years he's been playing on general forwards. Probably because they have had Bolter back there and things like that. So he might have to probably play, you know, go back to what he was doing 4 or 5 years ago and playing as that undersized key defender because he is only 192. And another general defender, the other tallest general defender they've got is Tom Brown, who's also 192, but he's sort of, you can see he's not built like a key player at all.
You think that if things aren't going well for the Tigers early, Bolter gets swung back.
A couple of big scores kicked against Richmond, and it's almost like, well, Noah Bolter has to go back because we don't
know. Tom Lynch will be back hopefully within the first month of the season, so that might be the catalyst for that move. But that is interesting.
When I saw that he was playing forward, I thought, well, you're the one team that can't afford to do it because you've got the fewest key defenders of anyone. Looking at general forward, so, you know, two different teams. Melbourne has 12 general forwards, which sort of made me giggle thinking about how much we were talking about their forward 50 struggles last year.
Yep. They have the quarter of the list.
Yeah, they have the most of anyone. I think the next most is 9 as well. So they're the only ones with double
figures. These are so interesting. And we did the positional rankings, which is live on ESPN at the moment. And off the top of my head, I expected to rank the D's forward line quite low, but they were at times 8th, 9th and 10th, and around that mark for me, which is actually probably better than I thought they would be. You say the 19 forwards overall that are on their list, they have a lot of options.
Yeah, with the 12 general forwards, which is the most of anyone, and St Kilda's only got 4, so St Kilda's got the fewest general forwards of any team. But yeah, you add in Melbourne have 7 key forwards as well, and they have 19 forwards on their list, which is 3 more than anyone else. So again, talking about that, you know, any of these players could end up, but you know, Josh Shackey might end up back, or Van Rooyen might end up ruck and things like that. So anything can change. But this is, again, looking at players of where they've played and what their natural position are. Mm. Melbourne have 19 guys on their list that want to play
almost forwards, and they couldn't kick more than 10 goals. Well,
the issue with their forward line was just their inaccuracy. Yes. So I look at a player like Cozzy Pickett.
Yeah.
4th most shots on goal last year. Cozzy Pickett had 85 shots on goal last year. Only 37 of those were goals. So you look at the potential there, and the only 2 general forwards that were, they had more shots on goal than him were Charlie Cameron and Toby Green. So they've got the options there. Obviously, Bailey Fritsch can kick goals, and they probably just need someone to really partner with Jacob Van Ruin. That's probably their only
Petty
issue.
Petty might be the guy.
Moment. Yeah. Going into Ruckman as well, there's a few teams. So Richmond has 6 Ruckman on their list. I think 2 or 3
of
those.
Make some of them a defender. What's going on?
That's what I mean. That's where I was sort of like going, how can you end up with 3 key defenders, 6 Ruckman? 2 of your Ruckman are project players. I think they've got one guy from an NBL.
So these positional denominators are based on where they played last year, or the majority of their time played last year.
Is that all it is?
From everything, where they played last year, where they played as a junior. We do speak to, if we're not sure, some of the clubs, it's a phone call. Where's this guy training?
Does hype come into it at all?
A little bit. So, not always, but yeah, general forwards, key forwards. We've got height as a flag to sort of say, hey, you got this general forward who's 198. We had that for Mac Andrew last year. Then we go and look at your defenders that you played on. If any of those have flags of being, hey, these guys are key defenders, then we would change you. But again, Mac Andrew was playing, I think, forward last year, and he was getting manned up by clear general defenders. So the height, you know, the height's only used as a guide. We would never have to be a ruckman because you're 200 centimetres or whatever. So there's nothing like that. But the Bulldogs, they've ended up with just 2 ruckmen this year. So we know they lost Jordan Sweet to Port Adelaide. But they've got Tim English and Lachlan Smith, who I've never heard of, but clearly a big guy rated in the ruck. But they do have Sam Darcy, Rory Lobb and Jordan Croft all over 200 centimetres. So Rob's the
Lobb's been the natural kind of second ruck over time. And
So again, and Adelaide's very similar. So they've got just 2 ruckmen. Riley O'Brien, who's been holding down the fort for 5 or 6 years. and Kieran Strawn, who has also been there for probably about 3 or 4 years. And going back before that, we had Sam Jacobs and Riley O'Brien. Sam Jacobs rucked week in, week out for 4 years, got injured. O'Brien was called upon and has taken it up. I'm making a big call. I can see Kieran Strawn being able to do that if his opportunity presents. He's been on the list long enough.
Philthorpe won't be playing as well, exactly, so the natural second ruck option that the Crows have has kind of disappeared. It's whether they want to play two.
Yeah, well, I don't think they'll play two or two ruck. At least you've got Philthorpe as coming out of the goal square and maybe as a bit of a forward presence. But yeah, it's just whether O'Brien does get an injury this year, you're going to see a brand new Crows ruckman, but he has been there for 4 or 5 years and you'd think he would have the sort of the body and also the you know, the knowledge of the game plan to fit in seamlessly. So Bulldogs and Adelaide, got to sort of protect their ruckman this year.
Interesting stuff. Look, this is, pre-season's dragged on. I know it's technically been shorter than other seasons, but hey, the real stuff is now upon us. Opening round kicks off Thursday night, and we're looking forward to it. Before we do wrap things up for this podcast, though, is the hype justified or is it hyperbole bringing back this segment again for 2024? JB.
Yes.
With the NRL's Vegas trip deemed a success, at least by those in the northern states, the AFL should try again overseas.
Hyperbole in a way, but justified hype in a way.
Fence-sitting.
No, I get splinters on the bum here, but they've already been to China, obviously. I don't think that was really a raging success, and the only reason
it's more of a Port Adelaide venture than an AFL venture.
Yeah, I guess so, but my point is they've already played overseas.
Well, they tried Wellington as well, the Cake
Tin. They've been in New Zealand as well, over in the Cake Tin, and that all stopped because of COVID, at least the China one did. I don't know where it could work. I know I asked you before, and you said India. I mean, they have a lot of cricket ovals. I'm trying to think of where they could actually hold a game of footy. Look, Vegas looked like a success for the NRL. I don't know if the AFL could follow suit. I know the United States, they do have an Aussie Rules Football League. I mean,
no stadiums. This is the problem. And this is the problem that cricket's facing in the US as well, is they don't have the stadium with the right dimensions. I think the great thing about NRL is I think they were playing on a slightly narrower field.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was almost a perfect for them to go to Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas and play there.
It's still rectangular regardless. So, yeah look, I'm all for the AFL trying to do that again. And this isn't a knee-jerk reaction based off the NRL's success from the weekend. I'd like to see it happen. I'd probably would like to see it in America. But again, as you say, I don't know where they could actually play it or where it would work. So I really
well, you've got to think time zones, make sure they're either similar or drastically different so that it works. So the US is one, maybe Singapore, a lot of expats in Singapore, you might be able to find a stadium. Japan, could you take it to Japan? Don't think they have the stadiums. Hey, where would you like to see the AFL? Hit us up at Footy Tips on Twitter. We'll take your questions, comments and suggestions for that as well. JB, one more before we wrap things up.
Yes, the AFL, Walshy, they must bite the bullet and introduce a red card for 2024.
Justified, been banging this drum for at least 6 years. I went back and read a yarn that I wrote when Andrew Gaff hit Brayshaw all those years ago. And I think the premise still stays the same. I think, if it's an act that you can clearly say that he's going to get at least 2 weeks, you might as well red card him. The team plays with 17 people for 5-10 minutes, then the sub can come back on and you're 18 and 18 and just one short on the bench. But I think we're nearly at that point where we're mature enough to have another discussion about red cards, that's for sure. All right, we're going to wrap things up there. Thank you so much for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Don't forget, Red Time coming this Thursday. JB will be there, Jake Michaels will be there, and we will speak to you in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.